Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. On today's show, we round off our coverage of this year's edition of the Milanese Design Fair Salone del Mobile by looking at some of the more conceptual ventures at the show. First up,
to me, it's not so much a difference between art and design, it's more of a graduation. There is no definitive line between the two. I often receive different comments. People tell me that my work is not art. People tell me that my work is not design, and that is exactly what I want to hear.
Designer and artist Tokujin Yoshioka tells us about his award-winning installation in collaboration with the electronics company LG. Next,
we realized really quickly that Sardinian artisans are in great danger of not finding the appropriate markets. You can't fall in love with something and want to protect it if you don't know it exists.
We speak to the co-founder of an interdisciplinary design brand inspired by the island of Sardinia. We also check in on the launch of Brussels-based design label Ars Fabricandi and take stock of some developments in tech design. All that coming up right here on Section D Monocle 24's dedicated design show. We're going to begin the show with a conversation with Japanese artist and designer Tokujin Yoshioka. At this year's Salone, Yoshioka collaborated with South Korean electronics giant LG on an immersive light installation inspired by science fiction. Titled SF, Sense of the Future, it was held at Super Studio Pew in the city's Tortona district and won this year's Milan Design Award, given each year to the best exhibition in Salone. Monocle's design editor Nolan Giles met up with Yoshioka at the installation to find out more.
It's hard not to notice the increasing amount of companies outside of the traditional design sphere getting involved with Milan Design Week. And while some efforts underwhelm, many are pushing the boundaries of what this fair is about. I've dipped away from the endless halls of furniture at Salone di Mobili's Fiera to Milan's Tortona district to view one of the better examples of branded content. A collaboration between Korean electronic brand LG and esteemed Japanese artist Tokujin Yoshioka. This mammoth installation is equal parts soothing and breathtaking and comprises some 20,000 OLED lights to form what the artist calls his sun wall. With ambient sounds enveloping the audience, the light undulates across a wall on a 9-minute cycle, creating a hypnotic and spectacular vision. Sitting down with Yoshioka, he tells me the exhibition is about depicting poetry with the aid of technology and exploring the human experience of light. The transparent furniture we're seated on, he adds, is more of a direct alignment with the traditional design world.
I try to create a chair that is not something physical, but is more something that reflects light in itself. Throughout the history of design, chairs are something that are very important, from Le Corbusier and Charles Eames all the way to today. So for this installation, I thought about what would be the chair of the future, and this is what I came up with. Today, it is showing moving images that relate to this installation, but the chair can be programmed to display anything, even the TV news.
Packed with people, installations like Yoshioka's are showing the impact that brand-sponsored installations can have at Milan Design Week. And while it is a notoriously tricky act to balance the commercial with the creative, in this case it's clear the result is harmonious. Before heading back into the heaving streets of Milan, I asked Yoshioka how he draws the line between art and design and what he feels the ongoing role of Milan Design Week is as these two disciplines come closer together.
To me, it's not so much a difference between art and design, it's more of a graduation. There is no definitive line between the two. I often receive different comments. People tell me that my work is not art. People tell me that my work is not design, and that is exactly what I want to hear. I would really like to create work that is above those definitions, and that is unique. For Salone di Mobile, I hope that this becomes a place where new, innovative work is shown. That's how it feels lately. There are many kinds of work to experience and enjoy here, from chairs to more abstract design.
Tokujin Yoshioka there, speaking to Monocle's Nolan Giles. Regional identities are famously strong in Italy, and the Mediterranean island of Sardinia is no exception, with political autonomy from the mainland and its own language. Kaya Chenven is originally from California, but after moving to Sardinia with her husband Ivano, she was inspired to start Preziada. It's an interdisciplinary project combining the world of journalism, design, craftsmanship and tourism. And at Salone, the brand was exhibiting at the Rosanna Orlandi Gallery in the city centre. Monocle's Chiara Romella caught up with Kaya to find out more.
I'm come from San Diego originally. I lived in New York for many years, then Milan, then Sardinia. And me and my partner, Ivano, who's Italian but with Sardinian heritage, decided to move to Sardinia because it's a place that tends to fascinate you. It's almost like a fever. It takes you over because it's impossibly rich with culture, heritage, with stories, with actuality as well. And modernity, it has a story that hasn't been told before.
And this story, this telling the story, is where the project began. You began by doing almost a journalistic service to the island. What kind of stories were you telling? And how did the idea to start telling those stories first come about?
For us, the important thing was to tell the story from our point of view, which is a contemporary metropolitan point of view, but to completely ignore the idea of a niche audience. So we talk about everything that fascinates us, and that can be the way that an old woman wears her hair, to the contemporary artist who lives in the mountains, to the plague of arson on the island. Anything that fascinates us, we find a way to connect it to the project and write about it.
Interestingly, the contrast between the minimalism and the over-decoration obviously also shines through the projects and the products that you've decided to take with you. So the project, the Preziada, soon morphed into a bit of a linking agent between designers, producers. Can you tell us how that happened? And also, how did you choose the products that you are showing today at Rosanna Orlandi? And what are they?
We began sort of naively thinking that what we could do is just do a bit of a census, a survey of Sardinian handcrafts, and put them all together in a beautiful little collection and tour the world. We realized really quickly that Sardinian artisans are in great danger. They're in danger of not finding the appropriate markets. And when I say markets, I mean even markets of interest. You can't fall in love with something and want to protect it if you don't know it exists. So the main thing that we found when we started working with artisans was that a lot of the objects that most fascinated us were not being made anymore. We started at that point. We started going to artisans and saying, this is perfect, this is beautiful, make it exactly like this and don't touch it for another 1,000 years. But we started noticing immediately that a lot of these artisans wanted to be doing something new, but had no idea of how to approach it. They had no contemporary language with which to approach it, and so therefore everything new that they were trying to do became sort of a sad copy of something else that already existed. So we decided to start the second part of the artisan project, which is where we invite designers to come to Sardinia and do a small residence. They live on the island, they eat on the island, they breathe the air on the island, and they have to really understand the Sardinia aesthetic because it's extraordinarily strong iconography already in place, and that needs to be respected. We have two pieces here with us that have been designed by designers and then produced by artisans. The collection Sisters, which are two vases that were designed by Valentina Camaranesi Sgroi, who's a Roman designer based in Milan, and she really took the two columns of Sardinian aesthetic, which are the feminine floral exaggeratedly decorated and a more pared-down geometric minimalism, and she fused them together in one vase, which we called Sisters. One is called Slender, Maria, and one is called Shapely, Tunda. There are two adorable little sisters sitting sitting on the same pedestal. The other piece that we have here was designed by a Parisian designer, Amboise Majard, who has a Sardinian wife and therefore knows the culture quite intimately. And he decided that he was inspired by the fact that during the winter time, it never gets very cold in Sardinia, and so there's no heating in the houses. The fireplace immediately becomes the heart of the entire home. It's where you sit and eat and talk and tell stories, and you all huddle together all for this 6 long months in front of this one fire. So he wanted to do a fireplace set, and we worked with a welder from the area. I think the thing that was so beautiful about what Amboise did is that he immediately understood that he wanted to contrast. He has a very precise line in his design, and he wanted to contrast that purity with the sense that you get from the fact that it's hand welded. So it was a very strong decision of his not to finish the set in any way, but to leave all of the junctures visible. The third way that we work with artisans is that sometimes we find something that is almost perfect, but hasn't been updated for what we really need today. So one example of that is the shepherd's boot. We found a model of a boot that's from the 1800s that you still see today. And the thing that's particular about the boot in Sardinia is that every town was based around shepherding. So that's a huge economy. It has a huge importance in the culture. And there would always be one cobbler in each town who would make all of the shoes for everyone in the town. So women, children, men all wore the same shoes. And often these cobblers would develop, either they would put a cap on the toe or they would have a particular type of stitching. And that way you would know that that person was from that town. And you never said, well, I'm going to go get a pair of shoes from the other side of the island because I like them. You would wear the shoe from your town. In fact, there's some interesting literature from, there was a moment in Sardinian history where there was a lot of kidnapping that went on between the different shepherds. And there was this story that you knew where someone came from because I could tell he wasn't from here because his shoes had this, you know, detail on them. So we've taken that boot and we've updated the materials. So it's all a beautiful Tuscan tanned leather rather than the really tough leather that they originally made them in and that you would have to break in for 3 months. But the shoe remained that same model.
Kaya Chenven there from Sardinian brand Preziada speaking to Monocle's Chiara Ramilla. Find out more at preziada.com. Still to come on the show, we survey some developments in technology design and wrap up Barcelona coverage by talking to French designer Quentin Vuong. We're going to take a break from Salonia now. Recently, I had the pleasure of being joined in the studio by Monocle's technology correspondent, David Phelan. He took me through some recent developments in the design of technology and the technology of design. We began by talking about mobile phones becoming a little more colourful.
Traditionally, computers were beige, cameras were silver and phones were black, and that's what everyone was used to. And I suspect in a lot of brands, black is probably still the best-selling colour for a phone. But then when Apple introduced its gold iPhone, that did very well and suddenly everyone was copying. And then metallic shades such as copper, rose gold have been very popular since. And it opened up the market to colourful phones of kind of increasingly every hue.
It's kind of remarkable, isn't it, considering how personal the devices are, the fact that they're on you, that it's taken tech companies so long to kind of diversify the colour ranges as a way of selling it as a more personal object. And I think you've got a few examples of some slightly more experimental phones colour-wise in front of you.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right, it is such a personal thing. And that's one of the reasons that in the Middle East, where people often wear just black or just very conservative colours, in those countries, gold is especially popular, or rose gold, because it's a way of really standing out and differentiating. And this is a gold phone. It's a Huawei P10 Plus in what they call hyper diamond cut finish. And in fact, if you run your fingernail across it, it makes a squeaky sound, which adds to the joy of it, I suppose. The Huawei has come out in 8 colours, which is the most of any phone that I've ever come across, including dazzling blue and greenery, which have been organised in connection with the Pantone Colour Institute. And blue, I think, is going to be a big colour for phones. Certainly Sony has recently released a blue phone, and this is the Honor 6 Pro. Honor is a sub-brand from the same company, Huawei, in a blue colour, which they are using as its standout colour for that phone.
Now, they're coloured, but they're quite subdued still, aren't they? I mean, even the gold one, it's a kind of dusty gold, a kind of matte gold. Is there any particular reason for that?
I think it's part of that conservatism as well, certainly. The Samsung Galaxy S8, their flagship, which they've just announced and comes out in a few weeks' time, that's available in some markets in what they call maple gold, and that is noticeably brighter. But I think there is still a hesitation about making colours too bright. Nokia did it a lot a few years ago. It had a bright, bright yellow phone, the 1020, that looked tremendous. But Nokia then faded away, so it obviously didn't do well enough. People look at the colours and think that's fantastic, but then they edge back towards the safety of black and silver.
And you've got a two-tone phone, a slightly more bold option in front of you too. It's an Apple iPhone.
Yes, this is the Apple iPhone 7 Product Red, which obviously is supporting the AIDS charity. Yes, it's a bright, vibrant red on the back, and they haven't coloured the Apple logo the same colour as the metal around it as they usually do. They've made it stainless steel so it really pops out. And you're right, yeah, there's a different tone in the antenna band. It's a slightly different colour. This has been controversial, though, because it's not red on the front. It's white, as many of Apple's phones are, and even the little ring around the Touch ID button isn't red, so it's divided people.
Is that controversial because of the sense that Apple is having their cake and eating it, being able to support a charity on the back of the phone but kind of maintain their brand identity on the front?
Yes, I think it's definitely that, and you could say, well, they just couldn't be bothered to get the red detailing right. I don't think that stands up because Apple is so meticulous in everything it does design-wise. I don't think Johnny Ive would allow a phone out that he wasn't happy with. But you have to remember also, this is money goes to the AIDS charity, but it's completely cost-free for the buyer. You have to buy one of the 128GB or 256GB capacity phones, but those are exactly the same price as if you were buying them in black or jet black or silver.
Now, we're going to stick with phones now and talk about an issue that I think it's fair to say gets people revved up a little bit more than phone colour, which is screen size.
Yes.
Now, I've recently purchased a Motorola G4, which is a kind of cheaper phone, but which has a screen so large that many of my friends and colleagues have mocked me for it and called it a phablet,
yes,
which I'm sure is a word that you'll be familiar with.
Yes, I'm afraid I am.
Before we launch into a discussion about where things are headed, tell me where we've come from in terms of screen size.
When the first iPhone launched, which was, you know, arguably the first phone that had a different kind of touch screen and it changed the nature of mobile phones in 2007, that had a 3.5-inch screen. And people were saying, this is enormous, I can't cope with anything as big as this. But they quickly got used to it. And then Samsung really was the company that said, let's make much bigger screens with its Note series. That had a 5-inch screen, in fact, slightly over, I think. But that was kind of considered absolutely preposterous. That was where the horrible word phablet came in. And since then, the holy grail, if you like, is to make a bigger screen but a smaller phone. And the only way you can do that is to have a phone that is on the front all screen. The new Samsung Galaxy S8 is so much screen on the front, there's no room even to put the Samsung logo. And this is the LG G6, which is also a big phone and has a very big screen, a 5.7-inch screen, but it's nearly all screen on the front. And what they've done, it's quite a clever thing here, is they've changed the screen proportions so that it's no longer 16:9, as widescreen TVs are, it's 18:9. And that means you can get a bigger screen, but it doesn't have to be as wide. So this phone, I don't know how you felt it in your hand, Henry, but it's much narrower and much more manageable.
And is that the compromise that brands are trying to strike? Is that the bigger the screen, the better? But, you know, some of these phones are so physically large, it's actually, they're not particularly ergonomic. It's quite difficult to use them.
Exactly.
Are they looking for a golden ratio between those two factors?
That's exactly what they're after. And everyone says you should be able to use the phone one-handed. You can with the LG. With the iPhone, what you have to do is double-press the Touch ID button and the top of the screen slides down. And that's a good way round it, but it's not the perfect solution. Ideally, you want a massive screen, but, you know, our hands aren't getting any bigger, even though screens are.
And finally, we're going to talk about an instrument for designers, a technological instrument.
So this is the Instrument 01, it's called, and it's called a dimensioning tool. And that just means it's a tape measure, really, but it's a pen, and it has a little laser light to guide you so you know where you're putting it, and you roll it along, and the top of it rotates, and it very cleverly, very accurately measures. This is also very well designed. If you pick it up by holding either side of the logo, the laser is always in a certain position and will always start in that way. But let me hand it to you. The idea of it is that you don't just have to measure straight lines anymore. So if you're measuring the seam on a jumper or a pair of trousers, you can do that and go off in the wiggly lines that you have to. I was told by the makers that they even found that in Canada, which is where it comes from, they found that there was a group of pregnant women who are measuring their bumps with it, because you can roll it round in any direction.
So I just want to make absolutely clear for the listeners. Yeah, so this is a kind of a stylus or a pen,
yes,
which can measure the dimensions of 3D objects just through kind of rolling it along their surface.
This saves the measurements that you record to a smartphone app. And once they're in that app, you can share them with other people, and you can translate them from inches to millimetres or whatever you like, or even work out what they would be if you were working to a different scale. So it has a very strong electronic and mathematical element as well as the sheer measuring.
Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan there. Back to Salonia now for our final interview from this year's show. Ars Vabrikandi is a design label cum showroom based in Brussels. It was founded in 2015 by entrepreneur David Perilli, and its first collection, designed by an international bevy of young designers, was presented at this year's Salone. Among the collection is a handsome bar cabinet by Quentin Vuong, a young Parisian designer. Monocle's Chiara Romella caught up with him at the show in the Baroque Palazzo Litter.
So Davide, as the owner of the brand Ars Vabrikandi, launched it in 2015, and this is the first collection. He selected like some designers from Brazil, Belgium, and Italy before, but he met some Baron in Art Basel. We showed him some sketches, some first ideas, and he was really interested to have like this international team, and he really pushed to us designers to show our personality and also our culture.
It's quite the location for the launch of a brand. I mean, Palazzo Litter, you can't get a lot more handsome than this. What does it mean for you to be showing here, and did you expect it?
No. So when Davide told us that we will be in Palazzo Litter, everyone was like dreaming, and we're like, wow, it's amazing. But it's also like the first time for me, for example, to be present in a such high location in Milan. Last year we were doing with Fabrica and Veuve Clicquot, we were doing an experience in Santa Ale with another like a different place, but here like I'm feeling more in the contact of the public, so it's great.
Just to describe, we are in a green silk panelled room where the products actually fit in rather seamlessly, because there's different kinds of items that you've created as part of the collection. There's an armchair, there's a little coffee table in the middle, a coat hanger on the back, but your design is a rather fetching bar cabinet. Interestingly though, the inspiration for it comes quite far away from the world of bars and drink making. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more?
So I'm from Paris, and my previous apartment, I had a view on the rooftop, and I was sketching about chimneys. And when I arrived at the beginning at Fabrica in Treviso, I discovered a chimney, two chimneys, and because they are very particular in the region, and I was interested in. So I decided to take pictures and like sketch more, and it became like a bigger project. So when I was speaking with Davide, he was interested, and we were speaking about presence and presence when you have the smoke coming out of the chimneys. So we were interested like to have a bar who is revealing and hiding as a continent.
So there's a mirror that you can either open up or close up, but also the legs of the bar itself are rather reminiscent of a chimney. Can you describe to us, if I didn't know, perhaps I wouldn't say, mm-hmm, but where can I see the chimney in the design?
This is a good question. Until now, I've seen just few references for like particularly like the chimneys of Paris, but I think it's kind of very niche. When I speak about chimneys, about people are like, what? Why are you interested in chimneys? But in Venice, they are very, very present. And like, what is interesting is like Venice is like a city who developed itself by very horizontally, and the only thing who is vertical is the chimneys, who is bringing the, I like to say that, an identity and a little touch to the building.
It's a very international project that brings together a lot of people from different backgrounds. You designers are all linked by your belonging to Fabrica, which is obviously in Italy, but the brand is Belgian. How do all of these nationalities and these sensitivities and sensibilities in terms of design come together as a unitary whole? Is there something Belgian about the brand, do you think? Or do you think it could be, it's a Belgian brand, but it could be anywhere else too?
I think the brand is definitely like Belgium. Like most of the products are like produced in the center of Brussels. So, and Davide is living in Brussels. But I think it's more about his vision about the design and the work relation that he had, like with the team and Sam Baron and Giorgia Zanetto. How do you say? Like in Fabrica, we are an international team, and it's really sometimes hard to understand each other because we have a different sensibility. But it's to be here in Fabrica since 1 year and a half. It's fun, but also like I've grown a lot, like being in contact of like such different culture, like living in Italy, but also like I have other designers present here for As Fabricandi. I'm from Taiwan, Spain, Ecuador, UK, and so. I like this diversity and like being able to see a same topic with different approach is making the project and the discussion richer.
What about your own background? What led you to Fabrica? How have you been enjoying the experience so far?
I was studying in Paris in ENSAD, and I met two teachers, Carlos Casas, who is someone who was working for Colors magazine, who is a magazine that I've been developed through Fabrica. We kept in contact, and then when I was graduating, I was interested to have like an experience more international, and I applied, and I'm here since 1 year now.
Quentin Vuong there, speaking to Chiara Ramilla. You can find out more about Ars Fabricandi at arsfabricandi.design. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Kieran Banerjee. If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to write to me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.